You know, I think most people would be surprised to learn that I didn't come from a broken home. I wasn't abused. My parents weren't addicted to any substances. I was not neglected. In fact, my parents are Italian immigrants. And when they arrived, they were often the victims of prejudice and marginalization. So racism wasn't any part of my foundation growing up. And I firmly believe, now having worked with hundreds of people to help them disengage from the movement, that ideology and dogma are not what drive people towards radicalization. Instead, it's a broken search for three very fundamental human needs of identity, community, and purpose. And growing up, I felt abandoned. I was lonely. My parents had to work extra hard because they were immigrants, so they were often gone 7 days a week, 14 hours a day working. One day when I was 14 years old, I was standing in an alley and I was smoking a joint, and a guy who was twice my age came up to me, and he had a shaved head and boots. He snatched a joint from my mouth and he looked me in the eyes and he said, "That's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile." I was 14, I didn't know what a communist, a Jew, or what the word docile meant, but it was as if he was giving me a lifeline. I had been so desperate to belong to something. I didn't have any friends. I was bullied. That when he offered me this lifeline, I grabbed it and I held on with every fiber of my being. It didn't matter what he was selling. I needed to be a part of something. And in the process of that, he drew me in, and he did give me a sense of identity and community and purpose. Of course, it was, you know, not a positive one, but it filled my needs at the time. And I had given up everything else in my life that was important to be a part of it, so there was no going back. And then for 8 years, while I was involved until I was 22 years old, from 87 to 95, I had doubts every day about what I was involved in, even though I was willfully committing acts of violence. I was pushing propaganda. I was recruiting people. I was spreading the message. I wasn't sure if I really believed it, because it wasn't who I was. It wasn't part of my DNA. But the power that went along with it was so intoxicating that going from powerless to powerful, or at least perceived power, was something that I was not willing to turn away from. The man who recruited me, that man in the alley, was America's first neo-Nazi skinhead leader. That gang that I joined in 1987 was America's first white supremacist skinhead organization. And it had started right in the alley behind my house. Literally, dead-end alley, where I was standing smoking a joint, directly behind the intersection of Union and Division Streets, if you can believe the irony in that. I didn't know what a skinhead was. Nobody knew what a skinhead was in 1987. Could have been ISIS. It wouldn't have mattered to me. Could have been anybody. I certainly had moments where I thought what I was doing was wrong, but I was also very angry. And for me, it was revenge. I definitely had moments where I thought to myself, like, oh, this is probably not the right thing. I still did it because I was angry. The ideology was a vehicle for me to be angry, and it gave me the license to be violent. It was not what drew me in, because I didn't know anything about politics at 14 years old. I joined without knowing a thing about it. But what I did know was that I was going to be part of a community, that I would have this identity of power instead of the powerless, invisible identity I had before. I've literally talked to thousands of people, and when I asked them, why did you get in? Like, what led you there? And they're like, I just wanted to belong to something. And then it turned into something else, and I swallowed it because it meant I could stay a part of it. Cults are the same way. They pray, they use fear rhetoric to draw people in. They have their own forms of propaganda and conspiracy theories. And it really is a movement based on the power of a very few who are manipulating the rest. And that's pretty much just like gangs or ISIS or the white supremacist movement. It's about people with very selfish agendas who understand how to manipulate others to serve their agenda. I lived in a very, very small bubble while I was in that movement. All my information came from people within the movement. So everything that I knew was based on a conspiracy theory. Once I was able to get out and actually feel love, when I had my child, as one of the catalysts why I got out and started to challenge my sense of what my identity, community, and purpose was. Once I experienced that, I knew that what I was involved in not only was wrong, but it wasn't something that I really wanted to be a part of or believed in, because I suddenly reconnected when I held my child with that innocence that I lost at 14. And I realized that for those 8 years that I was adopting a behavior, and I wanted to take that out on other people to prove that I wasn't that powerless kid. You know, once I got access and actually engaged with people who I had never had a meaningful interaction with or a meaningful dialogue with, I couldn't justify my prejudice anymore, because suddenly I realized, gosh, you know, we're actually really similar. And the nuance, the differences that we have are the cultural nuances are the beauty. Yeah. Those are the enhancements, the language, the culture, the food. That's the beauty of our world, because deep down inside, we're all the same. We all need security. We all want our children to be safe. It started with my son. And when he was born, it challenged my perception of who I was, where I belonged, and what my purpose was. Was I this neo-Nazi leader intent on destroying the world, or was I a father and a husband? Was my community the one that I had manufactured around me to boost my own ego, or was it the one that I physically gave life to? Was my purpose to, you know, scorch the earth, or was it to set a good example and be a good role model and provide for my family? And that was a dilemma for me, because all I had known throughout my whole youth, from the time I was 14 until I had my child, was being white power skinhead who was feared, who got in fights every day, who was traveling the country and the world and known. And suddenly I had this little boy and this wife, and their love started to push out some of that hate, and I started to become really confused, and I wanted to leave, but I wasn't brave enough to leave. I wasn't brave enough to leave the movement, because it was all that I knew. It actually took my wife and my son leaving me, divorcing me, losing my business, closing the record store that I had opened, because at that store I had started to meet people that challenged my prejudices, and I suddenly started to become very close with people I normally kept outside of my social circle. It was a lot of things that were like, what is going on? I'm so confused right now. I actually like these people. They don't fit the idea that I have in my head. And the demonization suddenly was overtaken by humanization. And these were people that I'd never in my life had a meaningful interaction with. And now suddenly I was like, I could be friends with them. And I actually like them better than the people that I've been surrounding myself with. I don't know anybody in the history of Earth that has ever changed their racist views because they got punched in the face or hit in the head with a urine bottle. However, every person that I've worked with and that I've talked to that has changed has done so because they received compassion from the people they least deserved it from when they least deserved it. That works. You know, arguing, debating, fighting only polarizes people more. And frankly, when we do that, they love that. There's two things that white supremacists love, or any extremist really: silence and violence. If we're silent, they grow. If we're violent, they're the victim. And they use that narrative and they grow. They recruit. You see, those are the bad people. We're the ones who don't have free speech, who are, you know, being marginalized, who are the ones that are hated on. They use it. They're smart. Why do you think that they march in liberal places? Why do you think that, you know, why do you think that they went to Charlottesville? It wasn't a free speech rally. It wasn't a Confederate monument argument. It was because it was a liberal university town, and they loved to go there. Why do you think they went to Berkeley? There are no Nazis in Berkeley. They weren't recruiting anybody. They were going there to cause trouble. My solution is we have to treat terrorism seriously. If there are people that want to do that, we need to, you know, find a way to stop them. But that's not the solution. That's a Band-Aid. The solution is how do we enable people so that they don't feel so desperate that they have to join extremist groups? And maybe it's not our responsibility to do that. Maybe it's the world's responsibility to do that. But that's how we stop terrorism. I mean, there are always going to be people who are, you know, mentally ill who, if they don't get the help they need, will commit, you know, some acts. But people like me, I was very close to, I stockpiled weapons for a race war. It wouldn't have taken much for me to walk into a church and murder people in the name of my ideology. I didn't, because I always, there was a foundation in me that always stopped me from going that far over the line. But there are people that are a lot more desperate than I was. I mean, I had a good family. I had a good foundation. And if anybody had just a little bit less than I did, I can see how easy it is to feel desperate and want to, you know, stake a claim as a martyr or go inflict, you know, pain on a community that you feel may have wronged you in some way. That is how we counter extremism, is not necessarily by focusing on the ideological factors, because by that time, it's, I don't want to say it's too late, because I never feel it's too late to reach somebody, but that means that we failed to do the work up front, and it's somehow led them to that conclusion. We're failing our young people. We're not, we're talking too much as adults, as leaders, as teachers even, where we need to listen more. While young people may not have all the answers and they may not have the maturity, they're very idealistic, they're ambitious, and if they have a passion, we should find a way to support that at a very early age. I was passionate about baseball and drawing, and I wanted to be an explorer. Had somebody walked up to me in that alley that day that was a baseball coach or an archaeologist or an artist, I would have very happily gone with that person and not this other person. The fact is there's not a lot of hope among young people right now. The way we stop violent extremism of any sort is by supporting young children at their youngest age to foster their creativity, to their passions, whether it's art or math or science or whatever they love. We need to find a way to amplify those things, because when we don't, and they have to find their own way in the world, sometimes people will intercept them at their most vulnerable times.